Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at the latest nationwide job numbers. First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're getting ready to grill some ribs. We might not have our usual 4th of July parties this year, but it's still looking like an okay weekend to get outside with the family and cook up a rack of ribs. Whether you prefer to smoke or grill, sauce or dry rub, our next guest can help make sure we end up with something delicious. Meathead Goldwyn is the founder of AmazingRibs.com and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. His newest book is Amazing Ribs Made Easy, everything you need to know about America's favorite food. Meathead, good to have you back with us.
Hello again, Rob. Hot enough for you?
It is a bit on the warm side. I was talking about getting out and grilling this weekend anyway. I don't know if I'm ambitious enough to do ribs this weekend, but I might get out with a grill. How about you?
Well, you know what? The great barbecue guru is doing hot dogs tonight. You can't have a 4th of July weekend without hot dogs.
That sounds good. I'll stop by. You can hand them to me from a safe distance, Meathead.
Well, oh, God.
Now, let's get into ribs. You'll grill anything, but ribs have obviously a special place in your heart. What is it that makes ribs such a perfect grilling food?
Well, they're really the ultimate American food. I mean, we eat turkey on Thanksgiving, and I think ribs is just the 4th of July. You know, barbecue is not, as many people think, an American invention. It was been around since caveman times and was heavily popular in Asia, Africa. But ribs as a cut of meat really is uniquely American. The rib bones, which come from along the back attached to the loin muscle, is typically served in Europe attached to the loin muscle. So taking them off the loin muscle and cooking them, because they're very tough, was given to the enslaved peoples. While master ate high off the hog, the loin muscle, which was more tender. So that's where the expression high on the hog came from. The African-American slaves figured out how to take this tough cut of ribs, because there's a lot of connective tissue in between those bones, and there's a lot of fat, and it's tough, and the wealthy people didn't want anything to do with it. They figured out that if you cook it low and slow, you can keep it tender, and boy, does it get succulent and juicy if you cook it the proper way.
And I should say, when we say ribs here, we're talking pork ribs.
Well, you know, there's beef ribs are fantastic, but you don't find them easily in stores. And, yeah, I think when we speak of ribs, most of us are thinking of pork ribs. But I'll tell you, I've seen more and more barbecue joints serving beef ribs. Yes, indeedy.
Now, you mentioned the right way to cook them. Number one, the key secret, if I'm reading your information right, you got to boil it first, right? I'm messing with you, man.
We like to say on AmazingRibs.com that if you boil ribs, the terrorists have won. Well, here's why. Now, boiling ribs does, in fact, make them tender, and it certainly speeds up the cooking because hot water transmits energy faster than warm air, so you can get them done a lot faster. But when you take them out of the water and you look at the water is brown. And that's all flavor that the water has sucked out of the meat. You know, water is a solvent. That's why you wash your car with it. It sucks flavor out of the meat. The way to get the most flavorful ribs is to roast them in warm air at a low temperature. We like to recommend around 225. If you get the temperature much higher, the muscles contract and squeeze out the juices, and that makes them tough. So low and slow.
Talking to Meathead Goldwyn about great ways to cook ribs, maybe this holiday weekend. Let's talk about that low, slow cooking style. To do it really right, we want to allow hours here. And this is an indirect grill. Tell us how we're setting up first a charcoal and then a gas grill to grill these guys indirectly.
Yeah, or indoors for that matter. You keep that temperature low, and baby backs will take 3 to 4 hours at 225. And spare ribs or the center cut St. Louis ribs will take 5 to 6 hours to get them up to. Now, you're not going to believe this out there, folks, but you want to cook them up to about 190 to 205 wow. degrees internal temperature. Now, well done is 155. This is way past well done. But what happens at those temperatures, especially if you cook them at a low temp, is it melts the connective tissues and turns it into soft, gelatinous material, and it also renders the fat. And that's what makes it succulent and juicy and tender. So if you're going to do them on a charcoal grill or a gas grill, you want to divide the grill in half. You want one side of it with hot charcoal or flame, the other side, nothing. No flame, no charcoal. And you're going to cook these ribs on the indirect or the no-flame side, where it's sitting there gently bathing in warm circulating air. You can throw wood chips or chunks on the flames or coals on the other side, and then that circulating air will be smoky, and that adds another flavor to the meat. But you don't want to put it directly over the coals or the flame, otherwise it will get too hot and shrink the muscle fibers and squeeze out juices.
Do we ever want to put a sear on it right at the end even?
Well, yeah, you know the answer to that because you asked exactly the right question. Yeah, when it's getting close to done, and you can tell, there's an easy way to tell. You should have a digital thermometer. If you're going to be a good outdoor cook, nothing will improve your cooking better than a digital thermometer. But another trick is you can take a slab of ribs and hold it with a pair of tongs and kind of bounce them. And if the surface cracks, you're probably close to done. And at that point, you want to put your sauce on. No earlier. You don't put the sauce on until almost the end because there's sugar in the sauce and it can burn. So you put the sauce on at the end, and don't go crazy with the sauce. I know everybody loves barbecue sauce, and I know when you're done putting it on with the brush, you suck the brush. But if you put too much on there, you just cover over the smoke. You cover over the rub. You cover over the meat flavor. So just add it on. It's just another instrument in the orchestra. And then you move it over the hot side, over the flames or the coals, and you sizzle on that sauce. It'll actually bubble. You'll see it sizzle. And what happens is it caramelizes or changes the molecular structure of the sugar, and that really amplifies it.
But you got to be careful, I imagine. You want to caramelize it, but not let it get to where it's burning? Is that right?
Yeah, you want to stand right there. When you put the ribs on the indirect side at the start of the cook, you can walk away. You can go socialize. As long as your temperature is holding fairly stable, you can, you know, let her go for 4 or 5 hours. But when you move it over to the hot side, you keep the lid up and you stand right there. Don't go to the bathroom. Don't go to the refrigerator. If you run out of beer, that's too bad. Just stand there and watch them because they will burn in a hurry.
Let's go a little earlier in the process now with that rub. Do we need to get that rub on there, you know, the night before? Is it like marinating or does it matter?
Well, most rubs have a lot of salt in it. They also have other compounds. They'll have paprika, garlic, onion, and stuff. But what's really interesting is salt can penetrate the meat. It gets a little electrical charges on it. It's just sodium and chloride, and they penetrate deep. But the other stuff, like sugar, 23 atoms, it can't penetrate very far beneath the surface. So most everything is going to sit on the surface except salt. And when salt gets into the fibers, it actually helps them hold on to moisture. So I recommend that you make your own rubs and you don't put salt in them. You put the salt on hours before you're ready to cook or overnight, but it doesn't matter when you put the rest of the spices on because they're not going in, they're just sitting on. Now, if you've bought a rub in the store, you'll probably notice it's half salt and you just paid a lot of money for salt. But then it makes sense to get that on a few hours early so the salt can get moving down into the meat.
Meathead Goldwin is with us, founder of AmazingRibs.com, author of the new book, Amazing Ribs, Made Easy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Meathead about cooking ribs? He has, I'm pretty sure, an answer. What to buy, how to smoke or grill them. If you are an experienced rib maker, what is your go-to method? What do you look for in a rub and or a sauce? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com. It's Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You looking to make some ribs maybe this weekend? Do you know your method or do you need some advice from Meathead? Either way, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from a couple people, actually, Marcus says, most importantly, never, ever wrap the rib. Now, you talk about this idea of wrapping the ribs on your website, Meathead. What's that all about?
Well, I don't know that you should never, ever wrap. A lot of competitors, in fact, do wrap the ribs. What happens is, but maybe I think this person's thinking in general. A lot of people will wrap it in foil and then throw it on the grill. If you've done that, you're just braising it in or steaming it inside the foil. But it's interesting, competing teams of barbecue chefs will occasionally roast the ribs in a smoky, warm air environment like we talked about, and then about halfway through, they'll wrap it with foil or even butcher paper, and that helps tenderize. They only leave it in there for about an hour, but it helps tenderize it. It's an extra step that you can do to make it a little more tender, but it's a waste of foil, and it doesn't make a huge difference, but it does make a small difference. And if you're competing for a $10,000 check, you got to get for every advantage you can.
The pratfall, though, is if you foil it for too long, if I read it right on your
yes.
website, you run the risk of mush.
Yeah, it'll come out mushy, just like as if you steamed it.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Chris with us in Adams. Chris, hello.
Hi. Well, you sort of stole my thunder a little bit because you know what you're talking about. I wanted to talk about sauce, though, and everybody needs to understand that this is a whole day project. This is not something that you just stick on the grill and walk away from it. The sauce that you buy at the grocery store is garbage, and you should never use that. If you're going to put all of that energy into building the right fire and putting your cherry or your apple chips on it and doing all that stuff with your ribs, the last thing you want to do is put bad sauce on top of it. So I'm just going to give you briefly my fast recipe. I take some bacon grease and I take the bacon out of the pan because you're going to put that in your baked beans later, and I saute some onions and garlic, and then I put in a big can of frozen concentrated pineapple orange juice, and that is the liquid base for your sauce. And then I add a whole pile of fresh fruit, some more fresh pineapple, mangoes, peaches, whatever you can get your hands on. And when this is all cooked down, you really don't have to add an awful lot of other sugar to get it to caramelize. You can put some brown sugar, some honey or something in there if you want to, if it's not sweet enough. And then a big can of tomato paste. Wow. And when you get that cooked all the way down, I take half of it out and put it on my meat, and the other half is for the beans. You just shoot your beans in there, and then you've got your beans that are matching, and then you put your bacon back in with your beans.
I'm coming to your house.
Wow, Chris, thank you. Wow, that's detailed.
That sounds like fun. I do agree. It's always fun to make your own sauce because people will say, wow, that sauce is great. Where'd you get it? Oh, I made it. Oh, what's the recipe? Then I have to kill you. You know that routine. We have some really good sauce recipes on our website, too.
That's AmazingRibs.com. Chris, thank you. That sounds pretty amazing, too. I love the double duty she gets out of the sauce. It goes on the ribs, and it goes on one of the side dishes, too.
Yeah, into the beans. Hey, you know, you mentioned the new book we just published about ribs. And I got to tell you, it's an e-book only. It's not in bookstores, so don't go looking in bookstores. My big book, the book Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, is in all the bookstores and on Amazon. But the rib book just came out 2 weeks ago. It's only on Amazon as an e-book. You can download it there, and it's only $3.99. But it's got just about everything we know about ribs in there, including a really good sauce recipe and a good rub recipe.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Kevin now in Rochester, Minnesota. Kevin, hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Hey.
I'm using a 20-inch Weber grill, and I seem to always cook it too fast.
Mm-hmm.
What's the secret of cooking on, of doing ribs on the grill?
Okay, well, actually, it's a 22-inch Weber grill, and the secret is to push all the coals over to one side. Now, a lot of the manuals show you pushing the coals to both sides and the ribs in the middle. That's going to be too hot. Get the coals all off to one side. If you're laying the coals across the bottom, you're going to be too hot. It's going to cook too fast. You're either going to burn them or they're going to be tough as nails. So you've got to push all the coals to one side. And if they keep sliding down, you can put a couple of bricks in there to hold them up against the side. And don't put too many in there. If you use a charcoal chimney to start, and that is the best way to start them, then use about 3/4 of a chimney. A Weber kettle, a Weber chimney holds 80 briquettes, so that we're talking about 50 or 60 briquettes. That should get you into your target temp of around 225, depending on the air temp. You know, if it's 96 like it is today, you're going to need fewer charcoals than you would on a winter day, for example. There's a gadget for the Weber kettle called the Slow and Sear. Slow and then the letter N, Sear. And it sells for about $100, and it's fantastic. It holds those charcoals up against the side, and it's got a water dam in there, which helps mitigate the temperature and also puts humidity in the atmosphere. And I've got an article all about it on our website. I don't sell them, but go read about the Slow and Sear on our website, and I have a link to the company that sells them. That thing will really up the capabilities of your Weber kettle.
Kevin, thanks a lot. Hope that helps. We are talking to Meathead Goldwyn about cooking ribs, grilling them in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's another comment from Facebook, Meathead. PJ writes, I actually bake my baby back ribs. Creates a really awesome consistency. I prefer, he says, a dry rub and multiple dipping sauces. And you mentioned baking earlier as an acceptable alternative. A little hot to start in the oven today, I'll say, but maybe in winter mm-hmm. we want those ribs.
Well, baking, I mean, when you put the meat on a grill away from the coals, you're baking it or roasting it. You know, it's a very fine line difference between baking and roasting, and I've been cooking all my life. I'm in my 70s. I don't know what the difference between baking and roasting is. It's just cooking it in warm, circulating air. And that's baking or roasting. And you can do it in an oven. And, in fact, a grill is just an outdoor oven, for crying out loud. Only it doesn't have a good thermometer.
Now, how about if we want to get that sear on at the end? Can we just do that on the stovetop?
No, broiler.
Okay.
You've got a broiler in there, and your broiler is an open flame. Now, on an electric, it's still right there underneath. So you put it in your oven. You set it at 225. You put it on a rack if you can, not in a pan, so that you can get warm air all around it. You don't have to flip it. Just walk away for 3 to 4 hours for baby backs, 4 to 5 hours for St. Louis cut or spare ribs. And then when it's ready, you just paint the sauce on and switch to broil and stand, just like with the grill, stand there and watch it closely because it can catch fire.
All right, Meathead, I don't want to make you mad at me here, but you say this is America's food and we're Americans and sometimes we want things fast. Is there, if we got that, you know, it's after work and we want to grill ribs and we want to eat them before midnight, is there an okay way to cook them faster?
You can speed up the process slightly by cutting them into individual bones. Now, when you do that, you're going to surround it with more energy. So if you cook it as a slab, it's only getting heated from above and below. But if you cut them into individual bones, the heat will come through from the sides. And that'll cut your cooking time in half. If you absolutely have to speed them up, don't boil them or simmer them or steam them. Microwave. If you throw them in the microwave, you can get them pretty thoroughly cooked in 15, 20 minutes and then just finish them on the grill. You'd have to experiment. Everybody's microwave is different. Another technique that has been working very well for me and a bunch of friends is sous vide. Now, this is the ultimate slow and low, but you actually put the ribs into a plastic bag, suck all the air out, and you stick it in warm water, about 145 degrees, and leave it there for hours. Put it in the morning, go to work. When you come home, it's thoroughly cooked. Then all you got to do is take them out of the bag, sauce them, and sear the heck out of them on the grill or under the broiler.
Hmm. That sounds really good. Well, I don't want to get out of here, Meathead, without talking about your favorite sides. We heard about Chris's beans and bacon earlier. What else do you like to have with your ribs?
Well, you know, I love to experiment. Anybody who's hung around my website knows that I'm into Asian and European styles. But 4th of July, man, it's Americana. You got to do ribs. You got to do beans. You got to do baked potato salad. Now, right now, our garden, the basil is in. And I just got somebody else was saying on the website, their basil's in now. So make yourself a little pesto or just chop up the basil, boil up some potatoes, and instead of mayonnaise, pesto potatoes are awesome. And they're perfectly wonderful in this time of year.
All right. And Meathead, you said your next grilling project is actually hot dogs. What is your condiment?
Well, I'm from Chicago.
Oh, so there's all
seven,
of them.
Seven ingredients, and you can't vary at all. And there's no ketchup allowed down here in Chicago. But, yeah, I mean, you know, 4th of July, we usually have a big party. The family, the neighbors are all over here. And you got to have hot dogs for the kids, and I always sneak one. My wife does, too. I love hot dogs. And so tonight is hot dogs. Tomorrow night we're doing ribs.
All right, enjoy that celery salt on that Chicago dog. That's key, right?
People forget the darn celery salt. Hey, Rob, you really know your food. It's so much fun to talk to you.
You too, Meathead. It's been a lot of fun again. Thanks, and have a great holiday weekend.
You too, everybody.
That's Meathead Goldwyn, founder of AmazingRibs.com. His latest ebook is called Amazing Ribs Made Easy. He was with us to share some smoking and grilling tips ahead of the holiday weekend. He's been on in the past to talk about his book, physical book, Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Coming up after the news, Milwaukee has been a hot spot for COVID-19. At some points during the pandemic, there's also a concerning trend when it comes to overdoses. We'll find out how it compares to last year's record-breaking season. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the United States added 4.8 million jobs in June. The White House says the growth is historic, but economists say that economic recovery is still a ways off. We'll get the latest news on job numbers. Now, COVID-19 isn't the only health concern facing Wisconsin right now. Officials in Milwaukee report the number of drug overdose deaths is holding steady and on track to set a record again. Edgar Mendez is a senior staff writer for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. He talked to WPR host Keely Boltina.
You learned that Milwaukee County's first drug overdose victim in May was 21 years old. What killed her?
Well, she died of a combination of drugs. One of them was fentanyl, which seems to be one of the main factors in terms of drugs that kill people. But she also was using Tramadol, which is a painkiller, and a designer drug. So she died of a combination of drugs, which is also pretty common.
And she's just one of dozens of people who've died of overdoses this year. What does the trend look like in Milwaukee?
Well, the trend of overdose deaths in Milwaukee has been pretty steady. So there's been around 40 overdose deaths a month so far, but there also is a good number of unconfirmed cases. So those numbers will definitely go up. And we're definitely on pace right now to not just pass last year's record high of 418 in Milwaukee County, but pass it by a significant number, could even reach 600.
600 people in 1 year dying of overdoses just in Milwaukee County.
That's correct.
People make assumptions, make judgments about who dies of a drug overdose. It's race, income, where they live, What did you find out about the people who've died from overdoses this year?
Right. And not just this year, but over the past few years, I've been covering the issue of drug overdose deaths and looking a lot closely at opioid overdose deaths for the past few years. And each year, the victims become more diverse. So while maybe a few years ago, it was more of a suburban white problem, now about 28%, 30% of the victims are African-American, nearly 15% Hispanic, and other races. So it's almost 50-50 right now. So that might surprise some people. And the majority of the victims were actually residents of the city of Milwaukee and not the suburbs.
So it's really happening all over.
Definitely happening all over. I mean, there was about six different zip codes in Milwaukee that had more than 10 overdose victims.
Is this Milwaukee's issue, or are other parts of the state seeing more overdoses?
No, it's definitely a statewide, not just a statewide, but a national increase that's going on right now. I know that I've seen that in Kenosha, they're having the same issue. Appleton, I believe Dane County has seen an uptick in overdose deaths. So I don't think that there's many areas of the state that haven't been touched by this issue.
Edgar Mendez is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and we're talking about his piece for Wisconsin Watch on overdose deaths in Wisconsin. The number is rising. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Edgar, Appleton police note that they saw more deaths in April and May. At that time, communities were restricted, activities shut down, only the most essential services operating. Did that contribute to this rise in overdose deaths?
I believe, talking to people who work with drug abuse, who work with people who suffer from drug abuse, they talk about isolation being a factor in terms of people isolating and using drugs. So with this isolation that was, forced isolation, it kind of created a perfect environment for people to get deeper into their drug use. And not even just the isolation factor, but just the stress, the increased unemployment, the lack of ability to go to group meetings or to access the substance abuse services that they had been using prior to the pandemic. When they kind of lost those safety nets, a lot of people turned back to substance abuse, and as a result, we're seeing an increase in overdose deaths and a decrease in access to substance use services.
Talk a little bit more about unemployment, because even if you were able to go to a job, you still had all of those other pressures. Now, if you have lost work, not only are you losing income, but you also have hours of time when you're used to being productive, and now you don't get paid for it.
Right. I mean, being unemployed is stressful for anyone, but for someone who maybe is in recovery or was still struggling, now they're faced with the stress of having to pay bills and have responsibilities without having a job. And like you mentioned, just all the free time on their hand. And it's not exactly the free time that anybody wants. I don't think you could speak with anyone and they wouldn't say that this quarantine and just the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic has been a good time to be at home. I think everyone's feeling that same pressure, and it's just about it just creates the right environment for someone to kind of slide on their rehabilitation.
Yeah, because it's work every day. We know that resources are a constant challenge. How are communities responding to this increase in overdoses?
Well, I know that as far as just the substance abuse providers, many of them transitioned their services to online, with mixed results. Some people, it's better than nothing, but a lot of people in recovery, they thrive on having that human interaction. As far as what the city has done, there has been an increase in funding in the Milwaukee area to support some programming to kind of tackle this epidemic locally. One of the programs is called the MORI program, and that's a collaboration between the Milwaukee Fire Department and the Milwaukee Health Department. And what that program, the Milwaukee Overdose Response Initiative, did is it has substance abuse or peer counselors ride along with paramedics, and they talk with people who overdose and who are resuscitated. So they kind of reach out to the people who are at the highest risk for suffering a fatal overdose and try to get them help at that crucial time.
So there's dedication of some funding for rehabilitation. Do you know of any additional funds for those emergency responders? That's time, that's staffing, that's, items and drugs and materials that you have to respond to these calls with.
Well, I know that there's been funds over the last few years that are used to increase the availability of Narcan. But as far as specific to those first responders, I don't know of anything specific. I know that they're really stretched out right now with just everything else that they're dealing with. And it's just this all hands on deck approach is kind of compromised when we're going through a pandemic, which is challenging everything else as well.
What are advocates doing to try to keep people who are in recovery on track right now and well during this outbreak and everything that comes with it?
Well, I mean, they're just reaching out, just trying to keep touching base, whether it be via social media, whether it be in-person visits or just calling them over the phone. I think that just checking in with them and just letting them know that they aren't alone, that they are not isolated, and that, that there are alternatives out there to deal with the stressors right now, and just kind of keeping them, encouraging them to stay clean.
Is there anything else you want people to realize as you've been reporting on drug overdoses in Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin?
I would just encourage them to reach out for services that may not have been available during the initial stages of the pandemic, but that may be returning. So I know that there are some group counseling sessions and other therapy sessions that are restarting again. And there are also online services. The Addiction Policy Forum has an online app to help people deal with, to support people in recovery during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I encourage them just not give up and to reach out for help wherever they can.
Edgar, thank you.
Thank you.
That was reporter Edgar Mendez talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. They looked at Edgar's article on overdose deaths. A version originally published by the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service was also posted on Wisconsin Watch. We've got a link to his article on our website. Find it at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, the June jobs numbers were released this week, and at face value, they look pretty good. But economists warn those numbers may not tell the full story amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll learn more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, for weeks each summer, decades ago, young campers gathered on Peninsula State Park. Our guest has compiled the history of the camp, and we'll learn what it tells us about our state's past. Now, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released the June jobs numbers yesterday, and for the most part, they look pretty good. According to the agency, roughly 4.8 million jobs were added last month. To put the June gains into some context, more than 20 million workers lost their jobs in March and April. While the new numbers are good, some economists say they don't tell the full story of what's happened to the economy since the COVID-19 pandemic forced businesses to close in the spring. Our next guest has been following the news and joins us to help break down these job numbers. Heather Long is the economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
Well, tell us a little bit about these monthly job numbers, this 4.8 million mark, and what it means when this was all collected.
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned, the really good news is we are seeing quite a few jobs come back. And thinking about the big, big picture here, we know that 22 million jobs were lost in March and April. And so far, a third of those have come back in May and June. So 7.5 million of the 22 million have come back. That's a good sign. And it's a big difference for those workers and the families of those workers. And it's faster than a lot of people predicted that we would see jobs bounce back. So that's all very encouraging. But there's a big but here. The obvious one is We've still got 2/3 of workers who are not back. Another big question mark is this data that's done by the Labor Department. It's captured on June 12th. Why does June 12th matter? That was the low point for the coronavirus cases in the United States. Since then, as many of us know, we look at these numbers, we've seen this big surge, particularly in the South and the Southwest. And what we're starting to see is people losing their jobs again in those parts of America. And so that there's a lot of concern that this snapshot of the jobs picture that we just saw in June with 4.8 million jobs coming back might be the best case scenario, and we might already be backsliding.
I want to give a listen to President Trump reacting to these June jobs numbers.
This news comes on top of May's extraordinary jobs report, which was revised upwards, by the way, to 2.7 million jobs. It was 2.5, that was last month, and that was a record setter. But it actually got a little bit better. We revised it. It was revised upward to 2.7 million jobs for a combined total of 7.5 million jobs created in the last 2 months. And that's a record by many millions of jobs. So it's 7.5 million jobs created in the last 2 months alone. Today's announcement proves that our economy is roaring back. It's coming back extremely strong.
And the concern is that the trajectory may not be there, you were saying, Heather, if these new COVID-19 numbers turn around some of those gains we just made.
Definitely. The other concern is a lot of those early jobs that come back were things like dental offices and restaurant jobs. And that's a good sign. But those were sort of the low-hanging fruit. You know, we knew that when your neighborhood ice cream shop or restaurant or when your dentist's office started reopening, that of course some jobs would come back. You know, it's going to be harder from here. You know, just when you ask small business owners in your community, even when you talk to friends and family who are small business owners, they tell you, you know, I'm only operating at half capacity. I'm still not back to normal yet. I don't know when I'm going to be back to normal. I don't know if we're going to have to put more protections in place. There's just still so much uncertainty, and that's making a lot of people hesitant to bring back the rest of those workers. So that's really the big concern. The other looming issue, the end of July, some people have called it a time bomb. There was so much aid. We did $2.5 trillion that Congress and the White House passed in March and early April to support the economy. A lot of that money will be spent and will start to fade at the end of July. So people are really worried, you know, have we seen this good improvement because of that money? What happens when it goes away?
Another trend that we've seen and that you've reported on is, well, we are adding these jobs. There's an increase in the number of people saying they are now permanently unemployed as opposed to, you know, well, maybe I'm temporarily laid off, but I'm coming back to this job. What are we seeing there?
Exactly, spot on. A number that I always keep in my head, the Washington Post had done a survey in April, and nearly 80% of workers who were laid off believed that it was just going to be a short-term layoff, that they were going to be called back to their old job by May or June. And we've only seen 1/3 of those people called back so far. So that's a pretty big gap between reality and what people were hopeful of. And as you mentioned, why are people concerned if the jobs aren't back yet? You know, maybe they come back July or August. The concern is the longer you're out of that job, and we have many years of experience watching this from the Great Recession, the longer you're out of that job, the more likely it is to become a permanent job loss. And we're already starting to see that. In June, we saw over 500,000 jobs were suddenly marked as permanent job losses. So nearly 3 million jobs are now permanently gone. And those people, you know, they're not going to go back to their old job. They have to start the search all over again. And there sure aren't that many job openings right now.
Heather Long is with us, economics correspondent at The Washington Post, looking at new federal job numbers out this week. Good news, a big increase in jobs after big losses from earlier in the pandemic. But some other less good news out there. Heather, let's look at new unemployment filings. This is another measure of unemployment that people watch for. What are we seeing in the trends for that?
it's really head scratching. Again, if we're really in a better place with the economy, you would expect that fewer and fewer people each week would be filing a new unemployment claim. Instead, it's totally stalled in June, and it's stalled at a pretty high number. Every week in June, we've basically seen 1.5 million Americans each week applying for with a new unemployment application. And that means that they were either recently laid off, or maybe they're a self-employed or a gig worker, and they really don't think they're going to get back to work anytime soon. So now they've decided to go ahead and put in that unemployment application. So that's another red flag that's sort of telling people, you know, yes, things are improving, but there's still a lot of pain out there, and there's a huge, huge chance of backsliding.
Let's turn and look at the people who have remained employed over this time. You wrote another piece looking at what's happening with people's pay. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, this is really different from what we've seen in any other recession. Normally, when bad times hit, companies are like, I'm either going to keep the worker or I'm going to fire the worker. Instead, we're seeing this middle ground in some cases where companies are keeping the worker on, but they're either cutting their hours. So maybe, okay, you're only going to work 2 or 3 days instead of 5 days a week. Or they're telling them, look, you still have to work 40 hours, but I'm going to give you a 5 or a 10 or even a 20% pay cut. So you have to do the same work for less pay. And so we have seen what we've seen in this article we wrote is there's actually 2 times as many job cuts so far in this pandemic recession than what we saw during all of the Great Recession in 2008-09. So it's kind of a mixed bag. Like, obviously, people would rather keep their job. That often means they can keep their health insurance. But this is a hard place to be. I mean, if somebody came to you or I or any of your listeners and said, you know, you're going to take a 10 or a 20% pay cut, that's really hard. You still have the same bills to pay for your rent or your mortgage or your, you know, your car payment. And so, again, it's another reminder that the pain is really deep in this recession.
And Heather, early on, even in COVID-19, I remember seeing some economists saying, hey, you're not going to solve the economy unless you solve COVID-19. And now with it roaring back the COVID-19 numbers, it's this huge question mark over everything we see. What are you watching for as this goes on, as the disease numbers comes up and how it's going to affect people's jobs, people's willingness to spend money?
It's, you know, people who get a PhD in economics and a lot of our top economic policymakers, they don't have PhDs in epidemiology, but they sure wish they did right now because of exactly what you're saying. It's so hard to forecast what's going to happen with the economy because it totally depends on whether we can get this virus under control. What I do know is I look at Europe, I look at Japan, I look at parts of China and Hong Kong. Those places have gotten the virus under control. The cases are going down. And you know what? Groups like Goldman Sachs now predict that their economies are going to grow faster this summer for one reason. The virus is under control there. In the United States, it's not.
Yeah, I saw Goldman Sachs. I've never seen anything like this before. They had an analysis showing the economic impact if we would just wear our masks on a regular basis, a huge economic difference maker, they say.
Yeah. I believe it said growth would be 5% higher in the next year or two if we would just wear masks. And, or again, just it, more so, I think it was indicative if we could just take measures in our country to get the virus under control. And you can see it. You know, there are parts of the country that have been able to do that, that have been able to reopen safely. I grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, you know, took some pretty draconian measures, but now they have been able to open up the state and you know, talk to my relatives there, and they're out and about going to the doctor's office, going to stores, still required to wear masks. But life is a lot closer to normal than it is even where I sit in Washington, D.C., and certainly in places like Dallas and parts of Florida right now.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Heather Long, economics correspondent at The Washington Post. She joined us today to talk about the June job numbers and what they tell us about the state of the U.S. economy during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. if your job has been affected, if you've lost it temporarily, permanently, if you've seen pay cuts, furloughs, long or short term. Love to hear your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or send us a quick tweet at Central Time WPR. Are you looking for a way to keep your kids occupied this summer? Here's one way for them to have fun and help out some lonely dinosaurs along the way. The Milwaukee Public Museum sent out a call for help last month while they're still closed to the public. I just found out about it via the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Quoting from the Public Museum's website, "We received an urgent report from our museum security staff that our dinosaurs are lonely. T-Rex has stopped eating. Dromaeosaurus is inconsolable, and Stegosaurus hasn't spoken a word. It seems they really miss everyone coming in to say hi to them." So that's the problem, but you, and maybe your kids, could help entertain those lonely dinosaurs. Almost said lovely dinosaurs. That too. The museum wants you to share with the dinosaurs things like drawings of a dinosaur, notes to the dinos, a photo maybe that you took at a past visit with them, make your own dinosaur dance, a video, make up a song about dinosaurs, a story, or just share your favorite memory of visiting the dinosaurs at the Milwaukee Public Museum. You can send your submissions to communications@mpm.edu. That's communications@mpm.edu, or tag your social media posts with #LonelyDino. They're going to share a lot of these online, and the museum says that the security staff is sharing the drawings and notes with the dinosaurs themselves. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.